and we sat down with the chief under a tree and negotiate our freedom. But at first, he asked me three questions. He asked me, are you from the government? And I said, no, I'm not from the government. We trust through. And then he asked me, are you from the church? And I think, well, if you ask me from the government, the church, there's also something wrong with the church. And I was still a pastor at the time. I said, no, I'm not from a church. Okay. Now tell me, are you a doctor? I said, no, I'm not a doctor. Are you a witch doctor? I said, no, I'm not a witch doctor. Now, how are you going to cure? I said, I'm not going to cure. I just want to unchain that because it's inhuman. He said, what are you going to use to do this? I said, love.
Welcome to the Dementia Research Project. I'm Matt DeRay, and in this podcast, I explore the history, innovation, and champions in and around the world of dementia. Barry Holzhausen is a human rights activist and the founder of Alzheimer's Dementia in Namibia. His remarkable journey began as a pastor, where his empathy for people with dementia led him to confront ancient customs, fears, and superstitions. His approach of compassionate care and natural therapies have changed the lives of many, whilst he has brought much-needed awareness of dementia to the entire region.
Thank you very much, Barry, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate this.
Barry, like, my knowledge of Namibia is limited to the fact that it's a very beautiful country with amazing landscapes. Do you mind sharing a bit about your homeland, like just in your own words?
Yeah, we've got a really a beautiful country. I always call it the jewel of Africa. In the west-southwest coast between Angola and South Africa. And on our eastern side, Botswana, as beautiful as Namibia, a lot of wildlife. We've got the oldest desert, Swakopmund, where I'm living at the coast, is in the Namib Desert. It is the oldest desert in the world, 55 million years old. Or must I say young if I looked at the stars. So, yeah, and we've got a lot of wildlife, a lot of the nature reserves, and from desert to forest. We are working up in the north. It's about 800 kilometers north from us, on the border of Angola. That's more like forest, you know, and a lot of elephants, a lot of buffaloes, lions, everything that you want to see when you come to Africa. I can't remember now that the squares of our country, but it's quite a big landscape. But we are only 3 million people. I think we are the second least populated country in the world. There's enough space for everyone. And that's why we've got a lot of peace, I think. They are busy discovering oil next to our coast now, which we don't like, because I think our peace will be gone. The big money in the world will start fighting over us. But that's more or less our country, very peaceful, very nice country, a lot of different cultures. I think we've got about 45 or 47 different Black African cultures. I also am an African because I'm already living in Africa, well, from my birth, but my ancestors came here many, many moons ago. So I regard myself as an African, just a white African. Sometimes people say to me, but you can't be an African. I said, well, listen here, my mother, I was born black, and my mother accidentally bought me in Blee. Now I'm African.
Switching gears a bit, Barry, growing up, you did a master's in theology, and you've got an honors degree in Semitic languages. Could you describe how your education was a formative experience? And then thereafter that, you were a pastor for over 20 years.
That's right.
Can you speak to that formative part of your life?
You know, I went to university only at the age of 32. My kids was already born and already in school in South Africa. And at the time I was working and living in South Africa. And I started university in that was, I think, 1986, something like that. As you said, I'm holding an honors degree in theology. I was 35 years a pastor. I was for 2 years in university, a lecturer in Hebrew language, the language of the Old Testament. I was also someone that I'm not thinking out of the box. I'm not even in a box. So I was also not in a box in the circles of religion, of Christianity, of the Reformed part of Christianity. People don't like one if you are out of a box, you know, and if you, I was always in my life an activist. First of all, I was an activist as a pastor for gay people. And in Africa, you know, to stand at the side of gay people, they don't like you. They don't like you to be here. They don't like you to be even a pastor. They can't even imagine you're a pastor. During my life as a pastor, you know, I met a lot of people living with dementia. I didn't know what it was. I, at that time, thought it was just someone getting very old and can't remember stuff and a change in behavior and getting slower and stuff like that. But I was definitely very, very wrong. So then during my time as pastor, you know, one of the things I did is I never could understand why in Christianity, for instance, why people building all these church buildings. And if I disagree with you on a certain Bible verse, then I'm establishing my own church, my own denomination. And what the first thing we're doing is build a building, a church building, you know, a house of God, like they call it. And I couldn't understand that, you know, we are still very divided in Christianity because of different ways to understand the Bible and to look at God and to define God at the end of the day. I also was then with my family. I moved among Indian people in KwaZulu-Natal that time in South Africa. Around us was a lot of Hindu temples and mosques and Buddhists. And this is the way I want to share with other people. I'm looking at God. Not that you are wrong, but I want to listen to you. I want to understand why you are worshiping in a certain way. I visited temples, a lot of different temples, you know, a lot of mosques. Sit down with Muslim people and say to them, but tell me about Allah, as you call God, and about the Quran. So I also had a copy of that. And so that helped me to open up for other people, people that's different from me and who grew up different from me. And my organization was called that time LYNO. LYNO stands for Love Your Neighbors Outreach. And that's the way I worked. You know, I didn't go to we were the only white African family in among 60,000 people. And they were so open, you know, all those Indian people, all those people coming from the East and invited us to the weddings and invited us to their homes. And when we moved in, there was the first time in my life I experienced that people just knock on our door and say, well, we're your neighbors. We just want to introduce ourselves. And they brought with them something to eat and so on and so forth. So sitting down with them, listening to them, how they think, how they believe. At the end of the day, open up people to say to me, but what do you believe, Ben? And then you're a discussion, not in a fighting with words, who's right, who's wrong. So all of this prepared me for what I'm doing now, that is working with people living with dementia in different cultures, in different religions, without religions, atheists, doesn't matter. That is not the question. The question is, I would want you to understand what's happening with your brain. I want to help you to understand why you're still alive. And I want to create a dementia-friendly society in order that people, after being diagnosed and family members of this person, can go still freely to the marketplace, can go freely to cinemas without noticing that you are different. Well, notice that you're different, but inviting you into there because you're still part of the community. That is the, you know, that is the hardest part of us living with dementia, is that you are disconnected from life. Because I'm sick, because my brain is busy dying, and I'm not human anymore. Who told you that? So you see, I started with this, and then I left the church as a pastor. I can tell you that I've experienced more of God's involvement in my life, in my work, than 25 years behind the brick walls of church buildings. I can say I believe more in God now than I was than I believed when I was a pastor. I mean, it might sound strange for your listeners, but in my life, it's true.
Is that you putting the theory into practice?
Mm.
The theory of God,
exactly.
Mm.
Yeah, for me, Matthew, it's my belief is very, very simple. I believe that if there is a creator of mankind, of the creation, then he, she, doesn't matter what we call it, can't be others than love everything that he, she created unconditionally. There's no conditions. Doesn't matter who you are, where you're coming from, and what you're wearing and stuff like that. So yeah, then I start to understand, working with people living with dementia, that you need love to work with, to care for them, to help them to be still human beings. If you don't begin to understand, I don't understand really unconditional love. I use the term, but I don't. It's too big for me. It's too it's too huge. But I begin to understand, among people living with dementia, everyone is different because everyone has got his and her own identity. Everyone has got his and her own type of dementia. Some can still vocalize themselves very good for many years, like I'm doing, because later on in my work, I was also diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And I'm living with Alzheimer's disease, for the last three years and 7 months. But long before that, because I know this disease so good, I start traveling the world to understand it. And I did some online courses at UTAS, University of Tasmania, understanding dementia, preventing dementia, in order to do my work, in order to put up a care farm. So one of the first things that I notice is that people living with dementia, specifically in our context, we are people of open spaces. We don't want to be locked in small rooms, in small spaces. I mean, I'm living in the desert. Mm. I can now drive out of my town in 5 minutes. I will be in a place where you can't even see with binoculars any other people. So you can understand what I'm meaning. So that's why I started this caring in 2011 on a farm, where people living with dementia can be free, can the wildlife was running around our house and stuff like that. You can hear the cattle, you can hear the goats. And at night, you can hear the jackal crying, and so I noticed it. But you know what? We don't need medication, not at all. This Western medication is sedated people. It is being drugged up people living with dementia, and it mimics them someone living with dementia using all these antipsychotics, then it seems that the person is in the final stage of his disease. And if you weed them down from this medication, you discover, no, all of a sudden they're alive. It's like being risen from the dead. And I noticed what a role nature can play in everybody's life, but specifically in people living with dementia. Yeah, that's where my journey started to understand also the role of medication. And we start with a philosophy that we call non-pharmaceutical care approach. And I'm not talking about medication if you've got heart problems, if you've got arthritis, if you've got diabetes, if you've got high blood pressure, that's if you've got pain, of course. We use the strongest medication that we can get for pain. You know, you've lost your mother through Alzheimer's, know that the final phase is, how can they put it, hard way to die. And that was also when we started very, very serious thinking about euthanasia. We don't practice it. We can't. They will lock me up if they hear this. If I even call the name. But it's a person in a dying process. So you don't take a life. You can't take a life of someone who's dying. All that you do is let nature take its course. And don't use, because Western medication is so well developed already that I can prolong your death process from 1 week to 3 years. Why?
Yeah.
So through that I will deplete your estate of the family, your life savings, and then your father, your mother, your husband, wife will die, and you will be left behind in poverty. So that's all the stuff, you know, that came to, well, as a pastor, I preach a lot of about this already. You know, people were, what are you saying? Are you playing God? No, I'm not playing God. Exactly the opposite, you know. I let what God put into life to be natural.
There's a book I recommend. You may have read it already. It's called Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. He's an American physician. He talks exactly about what you talked about. It's about the dignity of living a life well lived, right till the end. And
I see everything in life as dots, and the connecting of dots. The connecting of dots is what God is doing, but the dots is something that I and you get opportunities to get involved in life. Like Gandhi said, you know, be the change you want to see, and that for me is dots. And then we move down to Swakopmund on a small holding. So we've got a small holding, 16.5 hectares. So there's enough space for our people to move freely around. I've got different protocols in place. One of our protocols is you never close any door except when it's night. So everyone must be free. If I don't know how to open a door anymore, there must not be a barrier for me to exit the house and to be on the small holding, enjoying the Namib desert. But I went further with this because I've got now friends that's living also with Alzheimer's, frontal temporal dementia, Lewy bodies, different type of dementia. Friends that's not at our place, they're still living on their own. Tomorrow again, I'll travel with someone again. I can send you sometimes video clips what I'm doing. So I'm also doing what I call dementia tourism. So I'm taking people living with dementia into the desert. And listen here, Matthew, if you see the change in 10 minutes after we left town, after we left this person's house where he's very, she's very enclosed, nearly locked up into, and how this person changed, they start talking. If their senses start to connect to the outside world, your eyes, your smells, your ears, then yeah, when we met up with other people and I tell them that, well, this friend of mine and I am living both with Alzheimer's and we're driving on our own here, they start laughing and say, don't speak a lot of nonsense. How can you drive here on your own? You're living with Alzheimer's. Well, you don't have to believe us. But you did the same as us. Of course we are the same as you. The problem comes in where you lock us up, where you drug us up. It's not dementia. It's not the dementia's fault. It's not Alzheimer's fault. It's the medication's fault. It's the caring approach problem, you know. This long-term facilities where people sit in small rooms with long corridors. We for instance called aggression the international language of people living with dementia. By that we mean, if I'm aggressive, but I don't have words to explain to you that I'm thirsty, I'm hungry, I'm lonely, how must I tell you this to you? The same way a baby is going to do this. If a baby has got pain in her or his ear, what will they do? They will start crying. And then the mommies pick them up and run to the doctor and get some antipsychotics for them. Say to the doctor, no, this little baby is aggressive. No. Never. The mother will find out, is this baby hungry? Might this baby be thirsty, or is there some pain somewhere in this baby's body? Mm. And when she find the problem, she rectify it, and the aggressiveness is gone. The talking is gone, because the baby does not have words yet. We're living with dementia in a certain phase. We don't have words anymore. It's the same challenge. In my presentations, I always say to people, I'm not old. I'm terminal ill. I'm not forgetting. I'm losing the functions of my brain. I am my brain. And my brain is like your computer, is like your cell phone. If you delete some apps, you will not be able anymore to connect your WhatsApp with your gallery. If you deleted your gallery and send now a photo of Matthew to your friends to show your friends, this is how Matthew looks like, the guy from Malaysia. So that's exactly what's happening in my brain. So my question always was, if I've got this powerful organ in my skull called the brain, with 80 billion brain cells, how can I access the part of my brain that's still well in life, that's not been affected by dementia? Because after they say in medical science, if you die with Alzheimer's, then 60% of your brain is still intact. So I asked myself that question over the years, caring for people. And when I was diagnosed that day, my diagnosis process was about a year long, 3 different brain scans. And when I walked into my neurologist's room, he sprang up behind his table. He said, this is a miracle. And I looked around, where's this medical doc? He said, no, you're the miracle, Mary. How did you arrive here? I said, well, I drove my car. What? And he said to me this. He said to me, Barry, you know what? I am a scientist. I must believe the science. And here in front of my desk is 3 different brain scans over a period of a year, 6 months apart. And according to this brain scans, your brain is severely damaged. You're not supposed to walk, talk, or drive your car. They say, well, here I am. I'm walking. And that was 3 years and 7 months ago. And they want to write me a prescription. I said, no, doc, you know me very well. I brought to you many people that you need to diagnose. I don't drink this medication. I don't want to drug up my own brain, and I'm not going to allow this also. I start practicing then what I was learned over the years. For instance, a therapy to use my senses to connect into my brain. Because you must know, Matthew, one of the things that I discovered as someone living with the dementia is your brain and my brain 9 years ago work in a natural way. You, in the morning when you wake up, you don't lay in the bed to think, am I first going to brush my teeth or first going to make a cup of tea? And then, okay, to make a cup of tea, I must walk out of this door now and must put on the kettle and stuff like that. You don't do this. Your brain do this natural with you. You just stood up, or you just stand up and you walk into the kitchen and you put on the kettle, go and brush your teeth and you come back to when the kettle is boiling and so. My brain is not functioning like that anymore. It's not a natural process. I need to use all my senses every single second of my day when I'm awake and when I'm waking up to connect the world around me, to connect with my senses, the world around me to my brain that's still alive and still in a good working condition. So I know that I can't walk into the kitchen, put on the kettle and go and brush my teeth. As soon as I turn around and I can't see the kettle, it's totally out of my mind, 100%. But when my ears hear the kettle boiling, and then I know, I'm going to forget something. Then I'm running fast back to the kettle. But then I'm not turning off the tap of the water running while I was brushing my teeth. And then when I arrive later in the day again in the bathroom, then everything is flooded. You see what I mean? There's no natural process anymore. So that's what I learned over the years, and that's what I'm learning all my friends now, the people I'm caring for and myself, to focus. I'm driving on my own. I will be driving on Thursday up north because we are busy establishing dementia-friendly villages, the first in the history of Africa. And people always ask me, now, who's driving with you? I said, no one. I love to drive on my own. But Barry, I'm not going to get lost. Oh, well, maybe. Maybe. But there's ways that I know how I can get back again. Because I was taught in the army how to use the sun to determine west, east, west, north, and so on. So there's a lot of stuff that's still available for me in my brain. But my brain need my senses. That's what I want to say at the end of the day. Yeah, and I'm very excited about this. It took us 10 years to, in rural Namibia, people perceive people living with dementia as witches, as wizards. And then they start accusing them. And if for any misfortune, for any disease, even well-known diseases, for any death, they will always look for the witch, who is the cause for this. And if they find this person, and normally it's someone living with dementia, they will ostracize, displace this person, even kill them. So our village is a place for protection to begin with. And then we will train people, educate people to understand the brain and what can go wrong.
I read about the Himba Valley and somebody you encountered there called Injina. I'm not so sure if I'm saying her name correctly.
Yes. Yes.
That's what really set this whole thing off. Do you mind telling us about this story?
It was, when I turned 57, 11, 12 years ago, one of my friends, after his army time, he opened up a lodge at the Ipupa Falls up north on the border of Angola and Namibia. And he found me, he said, Barry, I built a lot of beautiful bungalows on the river. Come and visit me. He said, yeah, well, thank you so much for the invitation. Me and my wife and I drove up there. And then he asked me the Sunday morning, were you ever in the Himba village? Said, no. This is my first time at the far west, northwest of Namibia. He said, okay, I want to take you to one. And then he take me to the king, they call it the king of the Himbas, the headman, the chief. His name is Kapika. And he was not there at home, and then but he's got two wives. And then my friend Koos asked permission that he can give me a tour in the village, to show me all the different huts and why the hut is here and what is kept here and so on in this village. Around the village is the wooden fence, and inside the village is different huts in the circle, and in the middle is a wooden fence where they kept the cattle and the goats. So while you were walking me through the place and show me and the different lifestyles and so on, there was an elderly woman popping her head out of the hut. The hut was not very big, very small. She had to sit down on the floor to pop out her head, and she was shouting, crying, and asking, who's this? Is this the third wife of the chief? He said, no. This is his sister, but she is crazy. She is a witch. She bewitched people. What do you mean? A witch in 2012, witches? No, man, come on. You're making jokes. I said, no, I'm serious. She's very dangerous. She can kill people. And while we were walking, at that time I was already busy on the farm with people caring for people with dementia. I wrote my own training sessions and so on. And I was thinking about dementia, and I said, I can't concentrate anymore on what you're telling me. I want to be that lady. He said, are you sure? I said, yeah, please, man, take me to that lady. He said, okay, we'll ask permission of the headman's wife. And they asked, they were laughing and said, but she's dangerous. Yeah, they told me she's dangerous, but I still want to meet her. And then they sent the translator with me. And on the way, I asked him about her, and I asked, why is she not accepting the art? He said she can't because she's got chains around the legs and to the middle of the hut around the pole. Very small place. And she says, she can't leave, but I said, why do you do this? He said, because she's dangerous. She's a witch. She killed people. So, okay. And I said, but please take me there and please be my translator. And when we reached there, she was calm, but I could see in the entrance of the hut, there's a fire burning permanently. So if she unchained herself, she need to creep over that fire. And on her legs was burning marks, indication of she tried to do that. And then I asked him, start to translate to me what she's saying. And I asked, the first question was, what is your name? And then she just repeat, what is your name? But I want to know what's your name. And then she said, what is your name? And the only thing he could translate then to me, because he said, no, she's just talking nonsense. she's confusing a lot of different words that doesn't make sense. And then for me, it made sense because I'm working with people living with dementia. And then she asked for tobacco from Sesfontein. That was a place 100 kilometers from there where she grew up. And I asked him about this, and then I start to think about it. I think by myself, looking at her body, she was the intake of her food is next to nothing. And also not water. And later on, they told me they gave her only about 500 milliliter water a day. Can you imagine this? 500 milliliter water a day. You can't brush your teeth in that. You can't wash. You can only drink it. And when there was food left over, they push it into her hut with a stick because they were afraid of her, that if she touched her, that something will happen to them and so on. But Matthew, seeing this lady in filthy something being draped around her, and inside the hut was nothing. Not blankets, nothing. It was only the ground and her feces in the corner. I was very sad, you know. I was very, very sad. And then when I went back, I said to Koos, Koos, I want to unchain her. I said, but the chief is not here. We need his permission. And said, okay, when will he be back? Said, no one knows. No one knows where he is. But I will ask them to contact us as soon as he's coming back. And that night we sat around the fire, me and my friend Koos. I said to him, Koos, I can't go back like this. I can't leave her like this. How many years do you say? And he confirmed 20 years. I can't do this. And said, okay, I promise you, Barry, I'll phone you when the chief is back, and then you can come back and we can negotiate the freedom. And 3 weeks later, he phoned me. It's about 900 kilometers from my house. And I traveled back to her village. And we sat down with the chief under a tree and negotiate her freedom. But at first, he asked me three questions. He asked me, are you from the government? And luckily, I heard that he's anti-government. And I said, no, I'm not from the government, which was true. And then he asked me, are you from the church? And I think, well, if you ask me from the government, the church, there's also something wrong with the church. And I was still a pastor at the time. I said, no, I'm not from a church. Okay. Now tell me, are you a doctor? I said, no, I'm not a doctor. Are you a witch doctor? I said, no, I'm not a witch doctor. Now, how are you going to cure? I said, I'm not going to cure her. I just want to unchain that because it's inhuman. He said, what are you going to use to do this? I said, love. He said, what? I said, love. With love, I want to unchain her. With love, I want to care for her. He said, I don't understand this, but any case, prove to me that you are going to this. And then he said to me, because the church was here and they tried to cast out demons from us, and they said she's demon possessed. And then he said, okay, she's the demons is cast out now. Now you can unchain her. She's free now. And but let me just jump back a little bit. He also told me that he took her to a witch doctor in Angola, and the witch doctor said to him, just take care of her. Don't let her die, because when she dies, you will follow 3 days later. Now you can imagine this chief's fear when she's going to die. And remember, in Black African culture, they don't believe in natural death. If you die, it's because you are bewitched. Someone killed you. So you can't die of natural stuff, according to them. In any case, he said to me then we unchained her. And she went into the felt, and that night she never came back. And I was so afraid, and we start looking for her. 3 days later, we found her under a bush, nearly dead, totally dehydrated. And from that time on, I said, finished. And then one night, when I woke up, the kraal of the cattle and the goats were on fire. And I came out of my hut and I saw that was Gina. And now she managed to unchain herself. She strangled 6 goats because she was extremely hungry and thirsty. And then they've got a holy fire. It's always burning. And then she took a burning stick from the holy fire and she set the cattle kraal on fire because for her, fire, dead goats means meat, means food. And then he came out of it and then she hit him over the head and she nearly killed him because he's the one who chained her, you know. Yeah, and then the two ladies from that area, from that culture, brought them down to our farm, trained them for 8 weeks about dementia, about the brain. It's not a witch. Why is something going wrong? Why is people seeing other people who you can't see? Why is she hallucinating and stuff like that? So don't be afraid. And then they brought her back. And then on the 12th of December, the 12th of 12th, 2012, we unchained her. And we start caring for her and we built our own village. And she's got care workers with her. And 5 years later, the headman's son died. And I said to my wife, they will believe now the witch, strike again. Mm-hmm. And they're going to kill me down now. And then I negotiate again that I can bring it down to Swakopmund where we do have a place for caring. So Gina is still with us. Mm-hmm. And that is now, that is 2012, that's 12 years later. 12th of December this year will be 12 years.
Mm-hmm. Would you say this belief of witchcraft is prevalent in rural Namibian villages? Like this belief that those with dementia are, for lack of a better word, witches. Is that the prevailing thought?
No. Witchcraft belief in sub-Saharan Africa is part of the culture of all African cultures till today. They all believe in witches. From the president of our country till the cleaner of the offices in the hospital, the nurses work in the hospital. Everyone believes in witchcraft. And so people living with dementia, even if you are admitted in the hospital, you know, you are being maltreated. But I'm also belonging to a group that international group that is tackling witchcraft beliefs. So you get it in India, in Malaysia, in Papua New Guinea. You get it in Europe, you get it in the UK, in America still, the whole of sub-Saharan Africa. And now Saturday, the 10th of March, will be the World Day against witch hunting. So we are promoting this all over the world now. And I was by organization, I was the one who opened up a lot of dementia organizations in sub-Saharan Africa to understand that the witches they are talking about are people living with dementia, a lot of them. Not all of them. You also get witch children. But normally the witch children is coming from this, you know. And I met a lot of witches, so-called witches, living with dementia. We are also taking the witch doctor and the people doing the accusations to court, you know. Because in our country, it's a criminal offense to indicate that someone is a witch. And we've got a law, what we call the Witchcraft Suppression Act. It's already 83 years in our country. And after 83 years, we were the first organization who used this law in a court of law. And we won the court case. And we got justice for the witch. We relocated back to her village. And her son We put him into university, and he just last year finished his nursing degree, and now he's one of our team leaders in the Kavango, also for this valets, and because it's among his people that we are putting up the valets, because of one of the headmen's wife is living with dementia, and he called me last year, and he said to me, my wife is having this challenges, and she's a witch. And then I explained to him, and then he donated a piece of ground to us, and he said, listen, here, start up a place where we can educate people. Because I am at the point now that I don't believe in witchcraft anymore, the headman said to me.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Barry. You've been very, very generous with your time. I've just got two more questions. If you could convey one message about dementia, what would it be?
I will say, I will use myself as an example living with dementia. And I want to say I'm still human. I still can enjoy life. I'm just looking different to my own history as you are looking to history. I don't forget stuff. I'm living in the now and the here. And it's very important that everyone around me must be my EB, my external brain. Help me when I'm walking into the bank, to the financial institution to withdraw money. Don't misuse me. Use your own knowledge to support me, that I will be able to go out into the marketplace with freedom, knowing that the people around me, I'm in a dementia-friendly society, in a brain health-friendly society. When I get stuck on a train, don't know where to go, I will easily walk over to Matthew, said, listen, my friend, I don't know where I am. Can you please help me? That's the world I like to see. A brain health friendly world.
How can people find you, reach out to you, support your work?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn, Barry.Olshausen. I'm on Facebook. My organization is Facebook, ADN, Alzheimer's Dementia Namibia.
I'll put all these links in the podcast description.
Okay.
To your right. Social media, so people can find you.
And also on WhatsApp, you can use my phone number is on the email.
Okay.
And then my email.
Okay. Oh, thank you very much again, Barry. This conversation has energized me. I think I really come out of this with a deeper appreciation and understanding of firstly Namibia, but then also, like I mentioned right at the start, like seeing the world through your eyes through this conversation a bit. And it also makes you travel to Namibia.
Dementia tourism. Bring a few dementia people with you and I'll take you on a road trip that will change your life. You will immigrate after that to Namibia, I can promise you.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks so much, Barry. This has been fantastic.
Thank you for your time and thank you for letting me talk freely.
Thanks for listening. If you want more of these type of stories, interviews and guests, please follow the Dementia Research Project wherever you get your podcasts. Onwards and upwards.